This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So one of the first things I wanted to maybe talk about is the sculptural part of what I've been seeing here at Penn. And I didn't know almost anything about the project before I arrived. So to have your work return to the sculptural in such a strong way, of course, was very exciting for me, because that's where my engagement in many ways with your work began, with sculptural installation types of work before you really invested in filmmaking. I just want to talk about what it means to make a public sculpture. It seems to me that a public sculpture on a university campus, like maybe cinema itself nowadays, is one of the most compromised and degraded social experiences and forms that one can imagine. I hope I don't offend anyone from Penn by saying this. Of course, I come from a campus too that has lots of public sculpture. But how do you negotiate what it means to make a public sculpture on a university campus would be one of the first things I want to maybe talk a little bit about. How did you come to the form? What about the materials that you've used are important to discuss? What's the title of the sculpture that you've created? I have many things that struck me about it that I'd like to talk about, but I'd like to start with the sculpture.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't actually really made like a sculpture for almost 20 years when I started making sculptures again last year, but it's been something that's been consistent through the years I've been working, and that's been the relationship to one thing to the viewer and the viewer's body and the viewer's movement through space, but also actually a series of public works that have had different forms. So I've made the radio plays. So as my art project for a show, and something would be a radio play that was aired on like national radio, for example, in Austria or Norway or smaller radios. So it was something that occurred that people maybe found by accident, just by turning on the radio. So it wasn't something that was primarily meant for an art audience. And I also made graffiti works in much the same way, just to insert things in the city that people discover. And in instance of the kind of art community, there were some indications of where they could go and see them. But for the most, I think the most audience for these works were just people that were accidental passes by. And but it's so I guess it's a complicated situation to work in with public works. But at the same time, I really like audiences, and I like different kinds of audiences. And that's also something I like in this kind of movement between the art world and the film world that I do with some of my work. Some of my films are, depending on the country and the context, they'll be shown in an art gallery or a museum or some places in cinemas or art cinemas and so on. So, and in that movement of the work, I also encounter different audiences, and they approach the work in different ways. So they're not so bound by just one kind of institutional context of understanding the work, and that's something I really have enjoyed. But there's the other, so that's, I guess, the kind of appetite for engaging in the public. And also some of my film installations, like this is a film installation, but
have you ever done a university sculpture?
No, but I have.
Mm-hmm. One, he seems to think so.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember that piece that Mi Wong Kwon wrote about. The kind of sunk down amphi kind of thing,
yeah.
You know, like a kind of science fiction like bench is down into the landscape. Yeah. So it was a space to assembly. It was a sculpture. It was also a place for people to come and sit and alone or together with people and to use. So it was about making a kind of a social space or a reclusive space in a way. So. I've done that.
And where was that?
That was at the kind of University of Architecture in Oslo.
Uh-huh.
And then I've done other works for universities, I guess, like but photography, and now maybe a sculpture a bit like this. But I guess what I was going to say, some of my installations, film installations, have also been set up in situations where they were open 24 hours. So the art audience could come and see it at any time, but it were also people that just walked by accidentally and would go in and see the film and go out again. And I'm actually installing this film that way in Oslo in about a month, where it's in the public space, in an installation that's a bit like a building itself, but it's open 24 hours. So certainly some people know that it's there, it's artwork there. Other people just walk by it on their way to school or work or so on. So I've been occupied with engagement with the public and public space.
But can I press you a little harder on this sculpture that you installed on the campus?
Yeah.
I mean, it struck me when I saw it that it's very much reminiscent of kinds of public sculpture, kinds of avant-garde sculptural forms that we're familiar with. It's very constructivist looking, although it doesn't function in that transparent way as a structure. The sculptures that it's near on the campus are the very typical of public sculptures on campuses. They're either late pop forms with social reference, the Oldenburg, the Robert Indiana, or they are these forms like, you know, Calder is in every sculpture garden that we enter. It's a kind of post-World War II constructivist abstract form that your work seems to want to sort of engage. I thought at least your work seemed to want to answer to both those kinds of sculptures that are present on the campus, that we experience in these kinds of environments. So I don't know if you were thinking about that at all, or
no. I was thinking of that. I mean, it's two things that went into the work. I guess one thing was that I had already started to develop this kind of sculpture before I started thinking of doing something for Penn. But then, I showed one in a public site in Norway. But
that was made of chain link fence.
Yeah, but all that came from film installations and from kind of spatial qualities in relationship to the body and visual aspects, kind of, I guess, framing or photographic aspects of it. But in any case, I was walking around Penn and thinking about what to do, and I was really struck by these kind of, you know, monolithic sculptures, and so you have a sculpture here and a sculpture there, and so on. So that, I guess, together with some research on Philadelphia, just like pictorial research, just on how things look and streets and kind of, I guess, a situation of construction of building or decay and things like that, led me into thinking that I had to deal with it in a more complex way. I had this idea of the sculpture, but what do I do? Just put another sculpture on that side. And I think actually thinking about this this project in Penn is what led me to do this piece for this vinyl in Lofoten Islands, which basically I made a similar sculpture to this, a bit more extravagant and crazy, I guess, but placed inside the kind of hole left after a building that had been torn out. But that idea actually came after having been going through all this imagery of Philadelphia and the imagery of torn out buildings and basements and so on. So, So, that was the idea, but how to solve that in this situation wasn't that easy, of course, it wasn't easy to just dig a hole and make a construction. Besides, maybe that would be kind of totally wrong.
There was a proposal at the beginning.
But the wall imprint, I guess, is this thing that I wanted to give it a kind of economical ambiguity. It's like something.
What does that mean?
Well, that it's because this thing of inserting these sculptures. The sculptures are like these big valuable objects, prized artworks put into this context of, you know, kind of wealthy institution. And I wanted to maybe bring some of those things into this situation that had interested me by these other areas in Philadelphia that are outside the campus.
You mean on the level of material, chain link fence?
No, the walls, the cement walls, the kind of a fundament for a building or the kind of imprint of a floor plan of a building, but not quite built. So that was a way also to think about, okay, I want to put this sculpture here, but maybe I should think more of it in terms of an installation. And how can I make an installation outside in such a space where there are no walls and everything is kind of... pulled apart in that way visually.
How did you come to choose that particular site? and wide chain link fences.
Oh, that site, I guess that was a proposal from you and Aaron and so
yeah,
on.
But
and yeah. So, but but it was interesting because it's in the site where a lot of people come by. So
yeah.
That's an aspect I like, whereas actually it's a chance that many people will encounter it. And and the context of the old library next
yeah.
to the new school, I mean the science school, and so on was quite interesting. And you have this proximity to this other...
Can you say something more about the relationship between your work and Fisher Fine Arts Library?
Well,
and how you see, how it feels to have that work there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so aware of the history of that building as probably all of you are. So, I mean, for me, I guess the main thing was to be there in a spot between that building and buildings like the design school, and in that very public kind of mm-hmm. center axis of the kind of the campus, and with the Oldenburgs and these other sculptures around. So, I mean, because one of the ideas I had was also to just pull away totally away from that,
yeah.
and I was interested in sites out totally at the fringes. So I guess it would be two movements that were interesting for me. One thing, go to the fringes and try to be on this kind of threshold to the rest of the city, and the other thing was to just work with the kind of center axis of campus. And
it's fascinating that you were next to the most emblematic building. That's a very celebrated building.
Yeah.
So it's not an edge land, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So what happens to that title? I mean, it still seems to work in some interesting ways, but can you tell us about that title?
The title of the show, Edgeland? Well, that's something that I was thinking a lot about in relation to this film, and this film is shot at the kind of, I guess, edgelands of Oslo, this kind of where that city has these last kind of cramps, where it kind of gives up in a way. And you have visually you see it with these big built-up areas, and then suddenly it's just forest. But it's also this area that's quite unkept. Like the forest behind is kind of, you know, regulated, well kept. The urban areas are kind of well kept. But then you have this kind of threshold area
yeah.
That's kind of more left to its own devices. And yeah. it's so that was an area that interested me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I shot the whole film kind of in that area of the city, but I realize, of course, this sculpture is not in the edge land
yeah.
anywhere.
I think it looks fabulous next to that building.
Yeah.
What's your sense of it, just at a purely visual level, without knowing anything about the building? About how it sits in that space?
I kind of drew it up in relationship to that building.
Uh-huh.
The kind of...
Well, it's a quite aggressive
yeah.
form. I mean,
yeah.
in one level, it's very beautiful, and it's abstract intersections of planes, but it's also very butch, to lack of a better word, I would use the word butch for a lot of your sculptures. Dark, black forms in cheerful
George,
public
spaces. I don't see
spaces.
It that way at all.
I'm sorry?
I don't see it that way at all.
Really? My experience of Knut's work has been about a kind of stylization of the dark and the black and the use of that in interesting ways. The way I asked my first question to him about the compromised space of public sculptures on university campuses was not meant to just be, you know, obnoxious about public sculpture. I like public sculpture. But to kind of key into something I think Knut's work has often been about, I remember the title of a book you made about 10 years ago or longer now called Notes Toward a Dissipation of Desire. Mm. And dissipation, the early works you called psychasthenia, mm. that took on this historical term about the running down of subjectivity, the undoing of forms, the running down of subjects, the running down of identities, the destruction of things. I mean, that's very present in the form that you made for the campus. So that it's right in front of this very important architectural structure and library and institution for the learning that goes on here, I'm a bit interested in talking more about. I don't know if you are. But maybe we should go back to butch. I think it's very butch. I mean, a chain link
fence. Well, I would agree with
sculpture.
The other adjectives. It's the butch word that I find.
Punk. No.
Because he's basically he's basically knitting.
Anarchist.
He was sewing with that chain link. He was threading it through.
Yeah.
It has a diaphanous feel to it. It feels very to belong very much to the daytime as opposed to this work.
Really?
The light, the work changes so much over the course of the day.
So that sounds like the power of the aesthetic to transcend all negative impulses. It seems like the work wants to capture a kind of destructive impulse, the death's drive, and
oh my,
harness that for public sculpture. Yeah. It's for me, it's the great counterpart to love on the other side of the public space that it sits in. I mean, who wants to see the Robert Indiana love one more time? I mean, it's just a nightmare of
So where do you fit in this particular exchange?
Yeah. I do think of that sculpture as a kind of a monster. And
the Robert Indiana.
Kind of monstrosity.
It's Indiana, you mean?
No, my piece.
Your own.
Yeah.
So it's neither Butch. It's neither Butch nor.
Yeah. Well, but I think it has both those things in it, and I think maybe part of that is, I think, also because it comes out of a practice that's driven by kind of photographical work, like film and so on, because it's not necessarily the most interesting thing for the viewer, but the way I make it's also a lot about kind of framing and perspectives,
yeah,
and shortenings,
right.
And most of what you're looking at at some points are reflections of silver and air.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have it's this big heavy thing, but it's also
it feels airborne to me.
But I have been working on them, thinking them as this kind of monstrosities that's kind of rolled into a space, and that's one of the roles of that sculpture, and that it's kind of in between something being constructed and collapsing, and at the right sides. Maybe this is not the right site to comment on that, but maybe like for something more in Lofoten, that carried with it more kind of economic and social reference, you know, in relation to all the buildings around it.
Yeah,
you know,
do what you want to say
this,
more about that?
This kind of monstrous buildup of offenses thrown into this building site. So
something more maybe about the use of chain link as a medium?
Yeah. Well, one thing, when I first started to work with it, it was in relation to video installations, and I worked a lot with the installations that were built up like parks with living plants, trees that made the kind of subspaces within the installations, and it was all like live organic environment, but it was a reference to parks and parks at nighttime in cities, a kind of urban kind of narrative and subconscious of social spaces, I guess. Yeah. So, but then I was interested in working with the articulating spaces for these films that created the right kind of proximity between the viewer and the screen, and between and working with your accessibility to what you're seeing. So obviously in these fences you can see through them, but you can't move through them and so on. But it was also through looking at all these fences around commercial areas or ballparks and so on. So not a residential setting, more institutional or commercial use of dividers of spaces. And so that's how I first started work with it. Actually, first to do with the film Oblique, which was one of the films showed the other day.
Yeah.
And then it's gone through different variations. So it has that aspect. It's a cheap material. It's it's freely available in many countries. It's something that people do very quickly to erect divisions of social spaces, basically. So,
it's the anti-aesthetic.
But it creates visual accesses also, which is interesting for me in installation purposes. So I can build up an installation optically through the kind of transmission of light, a different axis, optical axis through the space, which are then different than the physical ones because you have to walk around.
Well, so would you talk a little bit more about the relationship between the work and the viewer's body, because you've mentioned that to me frequently and perhaps here also, and the inclusion of the tree might be interesting to comment on in the public piece.
Yeah, for the public piece, the tree I guess, different reasons. One thing was to try to to integrate the piece more to the site. So there's a tree there and incorporate it. The other thing is that sometimes these trees also these little tokens and parks and so on. Yeah, and I worked previously with this kind of mini park series, which were kind of about the kind of most reduced elements that you would have to create a park. So maybe a bench and a tree or a bush and a sign that said it was a park or something. And I studied this kind of idea of the mini park, this kind of mini urban space of withdrawal in many cities, including found some of the best examples in San Francisco. Actually, they even had these signs saying mini park. But I guess I attached to the idea of including that tree because of that. And
Viewer's body, you added some walls in the last little bit inside the space. So let's talk about the viewer's body.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really a kind of key element in terms of doing exhibitions, which is very different than showing films in cinemas and so on. And that's to do with the experience of moving through, or you are in fact moving through the space, thinking and sensing or whatever, as you are experiencing the artwork. So it also raises some challenges, like in this situation, about how to show a film that's 41 minutes long effectively in an exhibition space. And I really don't like these situations where you come into a black room and you can stand with one foot inside or outside the door and the film is there and you have no kind of chance to actually kind of sink into the space and concentrate on the work unless you really, really want to. So so I think that the films often for me have to have different roles. I do want people to come and see the whole film from beginning to end. But I also think try to work in ways where the kind of filmic image takes on different roles through the movement of the viewer in the space. And you can sit here, for example, in the back, and you can see a little bit of the image. Of course, you're not immersed in it in the same way as you're sitting here, listening to the audio in the correct way and seeing the subtitles the right way around. But you're participating as a kind of thinking and sensing, being through a work that has different kind of stops or levels in a way.
I mean, watching all of you sit in this room near where the screen is, where I sat and watched the movie before, clearly the reference is to detention. I mean, you're all incarcerated as viewers. That seems to be the unavoidable condition of being forced to watch this cinema of exhibition surrounded by this chain link structure.
But at the same time, it's
Come now.
I can't hear what you're saying.
What's new? Come now.
At the same time, it's a space that is I think intimate enough to see the film on your own and creates a. At being at the end of the installation.
No, of course it does that, Canute. But I mean, you're not saying you're not interested in this material as a social signifier
of course.
Violence and constraint and domination.
Yes.
I mean, maybe we should start to talk about the film. The center scene of the film for me is the fight scene. And we were just joking outside. I was joking with Nancy Davenport that maybe we could turn this panel into a kind of, you know, cage fight. Because that... is the that's the reference,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Exactly. Thank you.
He agrees. So I want to talk more about the film in relationship to this structure that's been set up around it and in relationship to the sculpture you've made. Can we talk about is there a relationship between this film and that sculpture, or are they separate works that just exhibit together here because of this dual exhibition that you've made?
I think there are connections, and maybe they have to do with some kind of a kind of you said dissipation earlier. One thing is the role of the subject and relationship between the subject and that sculpture. That's very fragmented, big, but also quite it's beautiful, but also violent, and through moving through the structure, you're of course experiencing it, but also being more exposed to it and so on. Mm-hmm. But moving through it, also your perspective changes and
I never had an experience with a sculpture like that, where moving around it, which is what we're supposed to do with sculptures, right? I was at the Rodin Museum today, circling and circling, but especially watching other people circling, it was like watching people try to break through spaces more than just move. Mm-hmm. How do you get around certain planes? Do you go underneath them? Mm-hmm. Are people gonna climb on that sculpture? I know you hope they don't, mm-hmm. but, It did feel like it was a successful instantiation of a condition of viewing sculpture that felt like imprisonment or escape, mm. or flight or capture. Mm.
Does that seem right?
Yeah, and with this film, I mean, the title is also Egress, which has to do with these kind of things, so possibility of leaving and so on, or actually the kind of escape of disturbances from a kind of main conduit or something like that.
What about the other meaning that I know this material has for you, which is construction sites,
yeah.
and the kind of non-place that is?
Mm. Yeah, I think for. I mean, I relate, I guess, those two things. One thing is like you have the construction sites, but it's all, and of course you have these fences in order to restrict access,
yeah.
And so on. But you can always see what it is that you can't get
right.
Access to, and that's kind of the part of the kind of violence of this kind of fencing. But it's of course also part of the kind of reason why I can use it so optically and so on in this installation.
Is the space that your walls create in the public piece analogous to the space that the fences around a construction site create?
Yeah, but I guess taken apart and made into a kind of absurd mm-hmm. construction,
yeah.
in a way. So an ambiguous construction mm-hmm. itself. Yeah.
Should we talk about the film more?
Sure.
With an eye to time.
Pardon?
I just have my mind on time. I was wondering if we should talk about the film.
Okay, yeah.
Kaja, this is maybe where you should jump more in.
Oh, gee, thanks, George.
I speak for sculpture if you speak for film.
Well, so let's talk about the relationship between the two pieces. Mm.
Between this piece?
Between this piece and the other piece.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm just trying to think of the most interesting way of talking about that, because they were obviously made at the same time and through dealing with much of the same material. And I mean, there are many things that are not really that direct references. They're quite different works. This film is like a 41 minute narrative piece and so on. But they both come out of working for several years with ideas of some urban sites, mm-hmm. and then in this case in Oslo, but you know, I've been using this material for many other reasons, but these sculptures came about through the same process of working with these areas that are under kind of mm-hmm. construction or collapse and so on, that led to this film also.
Yeah.
So there's these links in terms of dealing with similar material,
right?
Like source material, research material.
So I know you've some of your public pieces have been installations for video works. Could you imagine that? But in this case, you've separated the two. Mm. When you were here last year, you showed us some documentation of previous installations, nocturnal ones in which films were playing inside chain link fence like enclosures that had also a natural component built into them. And when you and I were walking around campus the next day thinking about a possible site for this, I think we were both thinking of something like that. So how did it morph into this bifurcation? What could you imagine a video component inside the public project, or not?
I was thinking that it would have had to take very different forms than the ones I've done myself with the larger screen and the kind of narrative video. I think my impression was at Penn there that putting that kind of installation then maybe on the kind of piece of grass or something wouldn't be any different than the sculptures that were there. Uh-huh. And most of the time people would just walk past them and you'd have this kind of projection with some kind of dialogue going on, maybe you could hear as you walk past. And I thought that maybe it was in that encounter with that audience that just walks by, that it would maybe be the kind of dullest and least engaging thing that I could do on that side. So that's maybe also how I started to think more sculpturally in relation to the kind of sculptures I've been doing.
Well, I'm very glad you did, but I'm just thinking back to those conversations that I know you were here with Aaron for some hours also during that trip thinking about this space, and then you went back with photographs and thought really hard about that. So I'm wondering, for those who haven't been in Slot before, it doesn't usually look like this. It's a very particular delineation of this space. And
this idea came very quickly. I mean, we adjusted it a bit now also during the last week and so on. But this main idea with the, for me, with the screen there and this diagonal and these two parts, one is just this more kind of distant area where you can sit and maybe think about other things or, I don't know, look at your phone and sometimes on the screen, and then the other part which is more concentrated on
It's like
the
a
film.
Public space that you
created. that came up almost immediately. And then I was trying to encompass other things into it, see more films and other ways of turning around the space. But this is more or less the first idea I had from coming into the space.
Yeah, that's great. So I love the idea of creating a public space in here. Of course, it is a public space, but in a different sense. So the film of yours that seems closest to me, I guess the two films that seem closest to me to Egress are Abyss and Tripoli. It was very interesting watching your films the other night, and all of which I already knew, although I know Tripoli less well than the others, to see the development over time. And I'm just was very found Tripoli very compelling. I love Abyss, of course. How would you relate this work to those two earlier works?
Yeah, I mean, they are the most recent films to this one, so of course there are more similarities in the ways I work. This one is more character driven to the degree that you could say there's a character here. Maybe this is the film I made that there's to the most extent actually a character, where the other ones are more or less characterless. And
yeah, I actually wanted to talk to you about that.
But it's also been a kind of strategy before. But on other ways, the working method was quite similar to Tripoli, which looks very different, but it was this thing of spending years and years of thinking about the film in a particular site and building it up, meeting people, doing interviews and so on, trying to build the film from a site as a kind of raw material in every way possible. So that the kind of work process was
quite similar.
Yeah. And but there are also other differences. I mean, this is the first time ever I made a film in Norway, and I couldn't resist making a film that kind of deals critically with the kind of psychological toll of the oil industry in Norway, which kind of sustains more or less everything there. So
I was very struck by, you told me once before that there were conflicts of a productive sort between your actors as to whether the acting should be Brechtian or method acting, and this strange kind of collision of those two between two of the actors you've used a lot. I was very struck by how close your camera goes to the face of the central figure, I was very intrigued by the particular relationship that the work is establishing or pointing towards between the face and what this is. It a psychological? Is it an inner space? What's the, you know? It didn't seem to be that way, and I thought of Bergman. I thought of other Scandinavian directors and the brooding interiority, etc. But we don't seem to quite have that, and the the strange non-site of the gas station convenience store seems to be related to this inner space. But how do you see it?
No, yeah, I guess similarly. I mean, that gas station is a totally over-commercialized space, and you don't really think about it when you go in. You just go in to pay and go out again. But visually, there's like branding absolutely everywhere, and you know, and some of it is also animated and so on. So it's like a whole field of depersonalization, and also relationship to the kind of uniforms. They all have the same T-shirts and same kind of pants and so
matching the candy.
But at the same time, I wanted to I wanted to have a situation where there is a kind of subjectivity there of sorts, and there is a person giving some kind of psychological response to her environment.
But how would you describe it? Because it seems almost unclassifiable to me that you're doing something different. I often have been struck by the way Godard would film Anna Karenina's face. She was playing a fictional role, but somehow the looking through the actual eyes of Anna Karenina, the face is being studied as if it actually is the key to the fictional character. A strange kind of blurring of the distinction between the two. That's not quite what you're doing, but I was surprised by how close your camera went.
I guess that's a kind of desire on the behalf of the viewer, you know, to link things narratively and relationship to character. So where you go in there and you look at the face closely, and you do kind of project so much psychology into that face, which is not really doing much else than just looking around. We tell the actor just to look around a little bit, for example, and that might be like a very strong moment in the film. But I guess making a film is about also kind of connecting all those particular elements.
But you used the word depersonalization a minute ago, and that does seem very germane here. So the combination of, I mean, imagine, of course, this is what one of the things your film is doing. Imagine working in that space, this place that you go into with in order to buy some Kleenexes or a can of oil or a piece of candy. You don't really register it as a place. It's a weird, your work has been about this relationship between space and place from the very beginning. And so one walks in and out without relating to it as a place at all. At least I've never gone into a gas station or a convenience store and related to it as a place. The idea of working in that space, it would be completely depersonalizing, as if you actually were effaced.
I think, well, for the people there, it's not depersonalizing. I think it's and you know, we worked with them for a long time. They have all their own. I mean, they go to work just as the rest of us go to work, and they have their kind of ambitions of their work day, and how many, and the boss has ambitions of how many buns they're gonna sell that day, or you know, these kind of things. It's just like any other store. I guess it's more depersonal for us that comes in as visitors. Because it's an environment that's not really made for us to stay in. It's just an environment that's made for making us buy things and expose us to all the possibilities that we could buy there, all little things, you know. I don't know how it's here in the States, but in Norway, a gas station like that is run by three different companies. So one company is just selling the kind of fuel. Another one will be selling all the food products, another one will be selling all the other kind of things, you know, and they all have their kind of market pushes into that condensed space, trying to get people to buy as much as possible.
Mostly what goes on, at least in Philadelphia and in Oakland too, is buying tickets for the lottery. A kind of place where you go to buy tickets for the lottery, but that doesn't seem to be part of the...
But I thought in that film that some of the characters are very comfortably seated in that environment. They're relaxed and they're fine. You have the Y who's maybe not that and who has this kind of reaction towards the end of the film, and she fills it all up with diesel and so on. But she has her own strategies of trying to make that space something of her own. By stealing candy all the time.
Why does she have a Range Rover?
Why she has a Range Rover?
This is one of the things in the film that bothered me immediately. At least coming from Los Angeles, the Range Rover means something.
It's an old but not too old Range Rover, so it's a cheap car to buy, but it's quite kind of solid and bush, maybe, as you would say. But it's not, because I had some weird thinking about that, and one of the producers said, oh, she has to have an electric car, because there's tons of electric cars in Norway. But in general, like, the electric cars are driven by the kind of the bourgeoisie or wealthy people. And
working
and so
class
on.
Subjects drive Range Rovers.
And other cars, yeah, for sure. Yeah. But it's not, it's not the 2013
The other detail that struck me coming from LA was I was immediately seized by the bacon-wrapped hot dogs.
Yeah.
Because they're illegal in Los Angeles to sell.
Okay.
But they seem to be a big part of what she was working on in the gas station. Is that... I'm actually asking the question, is bacon-wrapped hot dogs a common food in Norway?
Do you eat them yourself? I don't eat them, but at the gas station, that was definitely one thing. There always had to be some kind of sausage lying there being fried. Oh. But in this environment, also, they did it at certain times of the day because the different parts of the community would come by. So they had they didn't have many hot dogs out when the kind of customer base was predominantly Muslim those parts of the day, and then they had more in other parts of the day, and so on. So it was like kind of coming and going. Well,
they've been criminalized in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
On a more serious note, I was struck, one of the devices I was struck by, maybe it's a counterpoint to Kaja noticing the shots that tried to press so close to the main character's face, was that the gas station seemed to be a viewing station. That, like with the fence here in front of the screen, we were constantly looking through the windows. She was looking out the windows. Mm. There was that constant structure of looking.
And there were rows and rows of cameras.
The surveillance cameras was doing that as well. So that structure seemed to be really important to the film.
Mm. So that was something I could play on. I mean, it's kind of obvious that that place is also kind of a perceptive machine in a way. Because it has values and so on, and it's open 24 hours, so there will be cameras and all that. But it was also something I could work with filmically, to use this kind of repeat all these different kind of perspectives and gazes and an optical axis in the film. So it lends itself quite well to working with the film and be able to draw in different spaces of that little condensed space that the gas station is. Into the film through the cameras in the washing holes and things like that.
It made me think of this though. It made me think of like what it means to show cinema with sculpture, to look through sculpture to see cinema. Mm. It made me think of social structures though too. I mean, what are these structures of vision and seeing and interaction that are mediated so directly and strongly through other structures? And in a character-driven film, we usually want to. Kaja will correct me if I'm wrong. We usually want to identify with the characters that are being presented to us, and here we seem to.
So I represent now classical cinema?
I want you to speak to film, Kaja. That's how I see you.
George, I haven't taught film in 10 years.
Well, I'm treading on thin water, so I need your help, is what I guess.
All right. Well, that's a different matter.
Since I'm I never was in a past life a film scholar. But that really struck me for the social valence of it. I'm just making jokes about the film, scholar stuff. I was struck about the social experience of that kind of mediation now inhabiting our daily life, rhythms, actions, habits. So I could ask the boring question of Kadud, is that something you're interested in? Or I could say, can we think about ways in which your films have been exploring such conditions in other kinds of experiences, and I mean, in a sense, that's how I see your film project. Your film project is attempting to try to elaborate new film forms that are grown out of, like you grow a plant out of soil, some kind of new social condition that needs to be confronted and understood.
That is a suggestive remark. I think that Knut is going back to certain things that had been discredited as part of classical cinema by film theory and probably the camera being hovering closely on the face of the actress is one of those, and in a sense remaking them. So what do you think? Do you want to speak to George's point or mine or to both?
About
both would be a good answer.
Yeah, I'll have to think about it.
I mean, it's a huge thing to think to, but...
No, but yeah, go on.
No, you go on.
No, but then maybe you can frame your question again, so I have something specific to
talk to. Well, I mean, on the one hand, one, to speak a little differently about it, one consistency I'm seeing in your films that showing it here in the United States might highlight is how European they are. The subject is a European subject again and again in these films. Not all of them, but that's becoming their condition. That can be broadened out to more generalized conditions in social life, surely, but there's something about that that's very structuring in the films that maybe we could talk about, but there's also something about how does an architectural space form a certain way of acting that can become then a cinematic form? How does a social space like this gas station commercial market form a cinematic space? Why is it interesting to make cinema out of those social experiences? What hopes do you have for that, if I'm describing your project?
Well, I guess for me it's more really to do what's at play in those sites. So, so I've been using lots of markets and stores and things in other, well, lots. I've been using it before in my films also. And so it's this kind of highly commercialized space of exchange. But in this particular film, it was also about being kind of the bottom of the kind of economic ladder of the oil industry in a way. So you're on the kind of lowest, poorest paid jobs in this this structure that gives an enormous wealth. And but at the same time, you're the kind of meeting point out towards customers and into a kind of public. Mm-hmm. So it was, I guess, this kind of insertion of a kind of class narrative in the film there. And then I lost my.
I felt that very strongly in this film, of course, and I felt that it was something very different from the films we watched at the International House the other night, for example.
Which was different.
There was class conflict and social conflict and a stratification of social spaces in those films, but the characters all seemed post-bourgeois European teens or 20s, 20-somethings. Is that fair?
Except Opie was like 40-something.
Okay, well, of course, okay. That actor is an old friend of mine, and I know how old she is, but there's an assertion of a kind of youth character who we were not told in Abyss. We did not have a character who came from those sites of the market. We saw them, but the characters were the non-subjects of our post-bourgeois sort of, you know. What's the name for it? Someone can give me a better name for somewhat well-off white kids, mostly. Even when they're not white, they weren't. There was not that stratification of class and identity in the characters. The characters in the film seem to all share your subject condition, our subject condition. I don't want to pin you on the spot.
That's true. I agree.
But this film was different. You were in this film. Your daughter was in this film. But the character's class was suddenly shifted to an actual working class character. So that seems a big. I don't know what I'm saying. That seems like a big shift and change that I'm interested in.
I agree about that.
Yeah. You know? No, it's absolutely true. But I've always been trying to bring in a kind of economic horizon and a kind of social horizon into my films in one way or the other. And this time it was brought in through character, which it hasn't been done before.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we probably don't have time for much more, but I just wanted to ask about the relationship between the inside of the convenience store and the outside, which that seems to be a very differentiated. All the violence happens outside. So how are you thinking about that? It's a convenience store gas station, but clearly highly differentiated as an entity.
And that is the outside. Well, for her, that outside is a kind of a less controllable space, obviously. So that, I mean, sort of safer, but there's also this kind of build-up of violence and in that scene, that's part of it is funny, but part of it is also disturbing before the fight, and then this is, and it's all directed towards her, but then there's this implosion. Of the violence into the two male characters instead, that happens outside. So it's kind of
but she has a kind of
violence in that way.
Relationship of comfort and to the gasoline that she's pouring on the ground.
Mm.
I mean, her relationship to that is very complicated.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, well, I would say so. I guess that's
it's a release.
Yes, it's a release, and it's a complicated signifier. Obviously, she's like, you know, she's putting down. She won't have a job anymore. But it's more kind of, you know, it's a psychological effect or even effect of the film and of her situation. At the same time, it's in itself a kind of act of violence mm-hmm. on that environment or and so on. Yeah.
We maybe have time for one or two questions from the audience.
I can say something, okay? So that's please.
I just had a question about the main character's earrings, because they seem to the change according to her mood and according to her sort of emotional disposition. I was really struck by this very interesting sculptural earring she was wearing, and at one point she was wearing a peace earring, and she seemed to have a whole sort of repertoire of earrings. So, because, you know, I was relating to what Kasia Silverman was talking about the close-up of the camera, so I thought this was an interesting sort of mini sculptural device.
Yeah, she was using those things in terms of ways of, you know, kind of articulating herself and creating her own identity within that space. And it was actually inspired by one of the people working at that gas station in real life, who's always going through these kind of changes of jewelry and hairstyles, incredibly elaborate demarcations of identity, like in that space.
Where was it filmed? Where actually?
It was filmed in you never know, I can say anywhere in the world, but it was filmed in Rommen and Stovner in Oslo. So just kind of on the.
Can you say that again?
Pardon?
What did you say?
One place called the gas station's place called Rommen.
Okay.
But the kind of big area with all the apartment complexes is called Stovner.
Okay.
And it's an area of Oslo that belongs to this large kind of Grorud Valley, which has been normally all the representation from there is in terms of some kind of a crisis or something. But it's also a really interesting area because it's unlike the other areas of the city, which have very strong identities that go back, you know, hundreds of years. In some ways, things change certainly, and kind of former working class areas become hip or whatever. But they're still kind of working class areas compared to other areas in the West and so on. So they have this kind of strong narratives connected to them, but this area doesn't have at all, and it's the largest part of Oslo. And before the Second World War, it was mainly farms and a few houses. And then quickly after the Second World War, there were these huge complexes built to house migrants from other parts of Norway. And then later on, migrants from other parts of the world and so on. But it's basically an area that's been totally, the only stable thing is one of change, and it has all kind of different class layers and different types of houses and so on. But this is just kind of the very edge of it. And I know it from way back because my brother lived there and he was a dentist in one of these big complexes and so on in the 80s. So it was somewhere that I kind of, when I was starting to work with this area of Oslo, it was somewhere that I kind of knew what kind of material I could work with and so on. But also then to work with some topics that I felt that I really wanted to work with in the context of Norway, which also had to do with you have the gas station and all that stuff, but also a kind of economic or social strain that's not always brought up. But of course, this is not a didactic film; it's not kind of, and it's not a documentary. But I wanted to put these things into the film and have them at play in the film, so to speak. Yeah.
How did I know it? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to ask about you were talking earlier about the relationship between the physical space and the film, and I just wanted to ask whether the permeability
of the chain link fence was important to you, because it struck me that throughout the film, one of the striking aspects was that there was a barrier that was absolute, and yet it was continuously, at least visibly, permeable. This was not a wall that enclosed or closed off, but everyone was walled. And so there seemed to be a profound parallel between these two.
Yeah, that's true, and that's also what makes this lend itself so well to optical installations, I guess. It stops your body, it's absolute in that way, but you can see through it. And, yeah.
Maybe I'll just ask the...
Speaking of banality, most of us have, if we drive, or riding with somebody who might go into a gas station, I thank you for picking it up like that. You learned anything else beyond that?
If I learned more than that?
Beyond the banality of going to a gas station.
Well, I hope the film is about other things, but it could have been other spaces. It's most of that is a kind of commercial space where people
say
work.
Say
again. A space where people work and there is this exchange of
yes,
of
I
goods
agree.
And things. Yeah.
I agree.
Well, I'm going to take the liberty of asking the last question, which is, I know that it was the first time you were working with actors who speak Norwegian rather than English-speaking actors, and you told me that that had thrown you in various ways, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, even though, you know, I speak heavily accented English and it's grammatically all over the place and so on, still I've lived most of my adult life in English-speaking environments, and all my schooling and so on has been in English. So also, and since I moved to English-speaking environments when I was 17, so I've had that process of going from being a youth to becoming an adult and having my education, everything within the English language. And
yes.
So I've been more comfortable writing in English too. And that's what I've been doing most of the time. So this was the first time I wrote a film in Norwegian, and it's changed a lot. You can't just use the same, you can't just translate your kind of strategies in a way. You have to find very different ways. But I think that's one of the reasons why it took so long to make this film also, actually.
Yeah. So you said before you introduced the program at the iHouse, that you had done a different kind of writing with each one of the films. So when I was viewing them, I was tracking that, and it is in fact quite strikingly the case. And this also seems a different kind of writing.
Actually, that's true. I think in this, apart from the kind of opening and closing monologue of the film, which are, if you haven't noticed, they are a bit different, but it's almost identical. But they are stressing slightly different points. Apart from that, the language is extremely kind of economical and less elaborate and less poetic than in my other films.
Yeah.
So, and I think I wrote the script more out of thinking what I wanted each scene to do, and kind of, I guess what was the play and the kind of strategy of each scene, rather than writing it up as a dialogue, which is more how I'd done it before. But even though this is more naturalistic in the end and more conventional narrative, but it was written without that much emphasis on the sentences and so on.
I think it may be connected to George's point about the shift from dealing with figures who are like us to a character who would not stand there as in Filter City and make alienated kinds of declarations or engage in any of the kinds of speech acts that one associates with the characters in your other films.
Yeah. Something I would like to say, though, that those kind of utterances or those kind of monologues and so on is also a way of becoming like de-alienated or something. It's about kind of bringing meaning to a situation, bringing language to your experience of the world and so on. So that's something I'm quite occupied with, because these last days, I guess the word alienation has been brought up a lot. But I think it's not my primary.
I think it was being used by Homme, and certainly I was using it just now more in a Brechtian sense than in an existential sense. Do you want to have one last sentence? No, not you, George. Yeah. Knut.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Any more questions? That's my last sentence. There is one.
How do you say love?
Kärlighet.
Something that I noticed, at least in the second half of the film, was a really emphasized shift between scenes. They seem to be separated just with that long, dark break of blackness. And it also seemed that the blackness kind of resolved anticipation and suspense that was building up in the scene. And I was wondering why you paced it that way.
Yeah, without knowing exactly where you're thinking, I can just answer it kind of generally. That's two things. One thing is that working on the kind of viewer rhythm of a piece, the kind of concentration or I don't know or boredom or whatever that you kind of have through watching a piece. So you can have cuts or elements of black, whatever, that kind of punctuates things and make things more are more directed towards the viewer in a way. Or you can have very smooth transitions where things kind of blend through. So it's a way of kind of working with the whole kind of viewer experience or the viewer rhythm. But of course, there are other things too. It's like if you have jumps in time and jump from one scene to another, like how, it's not important to follow these things in any orthodox way, you know, like how you cut the film and so on. But sometimes you really need to put the piece of black in there for the view rhythm, actually to just make the transition from person being in that space to the other space, for example, or another kind of cut. So it's not. I'm not making a very precise answer, but it's. There are different reasons for doing
thank
those
you.
Kind of cuts. Yeah.
I got it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.